for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Syrian activists blame the government for an internet and telephone blackout as rebel troops moved closer to Damascus. The Palestinians won their bid for stronger recognition at the UN, and Egyptians protested a power grab by their democratically elected president. Joining me for the week's top international news stories on the Friday News Roundup, Moises Naim of El País, Ann Applebaum of The Washington Post and Slate.com, and Tom Jilton of NPR. You are always part of the program. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to have you all here. Moises, let's start with the UN General Assembly and the vote to recognize a Palestinian non-member state. How did that come about, and what's the likely fallout?
138 countries, Diane, voted in favor of changing the status of the Palestinian state. It used to be called a non-member observer entity. As a result of yesterday's vote, it's going to become a non-member observer state, which provides it is short of a full membership, and it still is a non-voting role, but it provides, gives it rights. It allows the Palestinian state to join some of the specialized entities, agencies of the United Nations, which creates all sorts of complications. The actual practical consequences on the ground of this vote are less important than the symbolic weight. Mm. And also what it says about how the world now sees this situation. And a very large number of countries that used to vote with the United States and with Israel in whenever these issues came up in the United Nations, this time either abstained or voted against, notably France, for example.
And Applebaum, it's good to have you with us. And the U.S. was adamantly opposed to this vote.
The U.S. was adamantly opposed, and I think rightly so, partly because I'm somebody who dislikes empty gestures, and I dislike these symbolic statements. Palestine, of course, could be and I hope will be a state in the future. But at the moment, it doesn't control its borders. It doesn't have a unified government. It doesn't even recognize they're a part of the Palestinian Authority, a part of the Palestinian leadership does not recognize the state of Israel. So, in other words, it doesn't accept the two-state solution that we all hope will one day work out in the Middle East. So it strikes me as a kind of empty gesture for publicity. I'm not sure how much it's going to help Palestinians on the ground, and I hope that they're not disappointed by it.
Empty gesture, Tom.
It's an empty gesture in the sense that it is not going to do anything to advance negotiations between the Palestinians and the Israelis. That's obviously true. Hillary Rodham Clinton, the Secretary of State, said it would be counterproductive. But let me just point out one little thing. This came in the aftermath of this renewed fighting between Hamas in Gaza and Israel. And as a result of Hamas resisting Israel, its political stature among the Palestinian people has really risen. And the stature of Fatah, the faction of the Palestinians that the United States supports and would like to promote,
led by
Mahmoud Abbas, has really slipped. So Mahmoud Abbas had this opportunity to go to New York and be very heroic and get this achievement, and that elevated his status in the Palestinian territories. That is something, perhaps a political benefit from this, that I would guess the United States would actually welcome. Anything that would elevate his status vis-a-vis the status of Hamas among the Palestinian people is probably considered a good thing.
You know, I wondered about that because, though the United States stood back and, in fact, lobbied against this vote, was there something in it for the vote to succeed? Do you disagree with Tom, Ann?
No, I don't disagree. I think it's often paradoxical. The United States, when acting in the Middle East, sometimes acts against its own interests or sometimes does things that have unexpected consequences. This might have been one of them. Although, as I say, I wouldn't overestimate how much this will have echoes on the ground. The United Nations is a long way away from Gaza, and it's a theoretical change rather than a real one.
Now, there's another element here, which is the U.S. has threatened to withhold money from the Palestinian Authority if, in fact, it takes its case against Israel to the World Court.
Yes, and the International Criminal Court, which is one of the consequences this vote may have, in the sense that now the Palestinian state can go to the Hague and claim that Israel is an occupying territory, can accuse Israelis of war crime and generate...
likely is that to happen?
We don't know yet, because as both Anne and Tom have said, we still don't know how this is going to evolve. One of the first consequences is that now the two Palestinian governments, both that of Hamas in Gaza and that of Mr. Abbas in Jerusalem, will have to decide if they can work together, if they will have to unify as only one government. They are divided, they don't see eye to eye. And again, there is the thorny issue that they deny the right of Israel to exist, which is makes it very complicated to advance any negotiations.
And what about ceasefire on the ground between Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza, Tom? Does that continue to hold? What do you see?
It continues to hold largely because it's in the interests of both parties at this point. But it is so important always to emphasize the difference between a ceasefire and some kind of political accord, which this was not by any means. In fact, there are major, major issues that have not been addressed. The Israelis, in the course of this action, destroyed a lot of the smuggling tunnels between Egypt and Gaza. And there's a question there of are those going to be rebuilt? Are we just going to see a reversion to the status quo ante, where there's a lot of smuggling of weapons into the Gaza Strip via those tunnels? Are the Egyptians going to do anything to block the resupply of missile parts to Hamas? And those Fajr 5 long-range missiles were very important in this encounter. Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, has insisted that smuggling cannot continue. But I don't see any evidence that there's been any agreement on enforcement of that idea.
And speaking of those tunnels, the National Geographic has a wonderful spread on those tunnels, what they look like, how they were built, how they have been disrupted, but it's a fascinating piece. In the meantime, we have news that Yasser Arafat's body is going to be exhumed. And what is that all about?
You know, it's funny. I live in a part of the world. I live part of the time in Poland. I've spent many years in Russia. And these are parts of the world where you do have a lot of conspiracy theory and a lot of suspicion of, you know, why did that person die? Why did this accident happen? Nobody ever wants to believe the truth. And I have to say, the exhumation of Arafat's body, even if the body is examined by the world's best forensic scientists, and even if a report is written that everybody agrees is true, nobody will ever believe that story. I really don't see what this will solve. You know, a conspiracy theory, the life of it, it has vigor and it has energy not because of facts, but because of what people want to believe. So I don't see any changes from this.
I agree with that. And, you know, let's remember, he suddenly died in 2004 and no one knew exactly why. There were all kinds of speculations. It was said that it was AIDS, cirrhosis of the liver, all kinds of things. Now what happened is that in some of his personal belongings, there was found high levels of polonium, highly radioactive the thing that really then created the motive for this. But as Anne said, it's going to be very hard to demonstrate anything, and people that believe what they believe are not going to be changed by data.
Tom.
Because this is a radioactive substance that was allegedly found, it decomposes very quickly, and it's been now, 8 years since he died, and the chances, therefore, of them actually being able to find enough to provide some kind of conclusive answers are minimal, which goes to Anne's point that, you know, for all of the fuss around this, it's not likely to demonstrate anything.
How did this whole idea of exhumation get started?
Well, as Moises said, there have been suspicions from the very beginning,
right,
that he died so suddenly and so dramatically.
But then
that,
why wouldn't they have done those kinds of tests immediately? Why wait 8 years? What's the motivation going on now?
I think that, you know, there was interest among the demands among the Palestinians to do some kind of investigation, but they didn't have the capability to do it. Some of his family or friends had clothes, as Moises said, of his, that and they finally found some Swiss investigators who were willing to do it, but it took some time.
Oh, I see. All right. Tom Gelton of NPR, he's national security correspondent, and Applebaum of the Washington Post and Slate foreign affairs columnist. She is the author of a new book, Iron Curtain, The Crushing of Eastern Europe, 1944 to 1956, and Moises Naim. He's with El Pais and author of the forthcoming book, The End of Power. Short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup, this week with Moises Naim of El Pais and Applebaum of the Washington Post and Slate foreign affairs columnist, and Tom Gelton, NPR national security correspondent. We've just had a report from the BBC that Israel is going to build 3,000 new settler homes following the UN vote. Let's move on now to Syria. Tom Gelton, where the country's internet and airport are shut down. This is totally unprecedented.
It's mostly unprecedented. The authorities in Syria have attempted to cut internet access and telephone communications before, but never has it been done in this absolutely blanket manner where all communication has been shut off, with the exception of those lucky rebel and activist groups who actually have satellite phones that they're able to bypass sort of the local telecom infrastructure. But except for those satellite communications, the people of Syria basically have no communication capabilities now with the outside world. And the speculation, of course, is that this shows either that things have really deteriorated badly for the government in the last few weeks, or that the government is preparing to launch some major bloody new offensive that they don't want transparency about.
And
or it could be both. I mean, we could be seeing a kind of end game developing right now. One of the things when I heard that news is I thought that it's time now to really pick up and speed up our efforts in Syria to begin talking now about the transition. One of the things you can do in a situation like this, when there seems to be so little that it seems so hopeless, is to begin getting people to think now about what they want to have happen next. You know, if Assad falls, if some kind of deal with people around him can be reached. I mean, there are a number of scenarios that you could see happening in Syria now. And I hope that the United States, the international community, and the Syrians themselves, especially the Syrian diaspora, don't suddenly find themselves caught out with a very rapid change and with having not thought about what they want to have happen next. The effort to organize the Syrian opposition, which happened in the last couple of weeks, was very, very important. But that's really just the beginning. What needs to be done now is serious work, thinking about what kind of a transitional government they want, what kind of a provisional arrangements they want to make. And I know that it sounds like it's too early to do that, but if you do it now, as we've seen in other parts of the world, if you begin thinking about it now, you might be able to hasten the end of the regime.
In the meantime, the U.S. appears ready to recognize the opposition.
Yes, Diane, and that's a very important change. And just yesterday, Hillary Clinton said that she now thinks that the Syrian opposition has finally organized better, has unified, and it's more of a unified player. And therefore, she said, you know, a day doesn't go by that we don't consider what to do and how to increase our support and our role for the opposition in Syria and our role there. And it will happen. I do believe that, as Anne and Tom have said, we are coming at a different stage. We're entering a different stage. We don't know what is the natural outcome of this, because we have entered into horrible different stages before, hoping that it was going to be an end to this massacre, and it hasn't. But let's see what happens next here. And there is a lot of other regional players involved. There is the role of Syria, and there is a very interesting role of a small country that is gaining a very large presence in the Middle East, and that is Qatar. Qatar had a role in Libya in the revolution against Gaddafi, and in Egypt, and the emir visited Gaza just before the war and all that. So, and it's playing a very important role in Syria. The paradoxes in this region, there are always paradoxes, is that at the same time that the Qatari government is intervening everywhere else to fight tyrants in its in Qatar, just recently, they gave a life term in prison to a poet, accusing him of charged with insulting the emir. And so this person is going to be spending his life in jail for just the kinds of behavior that they are fighting to avoid and to stem in other countries.
And what about the role of Russia in Syria?
Yes, this is a very Russia's playing a very important and somewhat strange role in Syria. I don't think Russia has any real strategic interest in Syria, but it does have it's begun to attach its prestige to the idea that the Syrian regime should exist. What the Russians have a kind of ideological interest in Syria. They don't want to see another regime, an authoritarian regime, toppled by a popular uprising. It has too many echoes for them at home, and they don't want to see it happen here in particular, because they have somehow given backing to the Syrian regime, and they feel it would undermine them. So one of the questions is, at some point, this Syrian regime runs out of money, and they run out of support. Who's going to continue supplying that money and support? Iran has an extremely weak economy, is in terrible condition. We may find that it's the Russians who are doing it. Will they want to do it? Will they want to keep doing it? How much do they care about this? That's going to be very it's been an overlooked piece of this puzzle.
Tom.
Well, just one final point, which is that really what's been significant in the last few weeks is not, in spite of what Moises rightfully said, is not the political progress that's been made. I mean, there is now this shell of an opposition group. It's really been a military development that has changed the situation. These rebel forces in Syria have overrun a number of government army bases and in the process acquired weapons that they did not have before, including portable surface-to-air missiles, which they this week used for the first time in a very dramatic fashion. So we're and as you said at the beginning, the airport in Damascus is now closed as a result of heavy fighting around there. So we're really seeing some real changes on the ground from a military point of view, but I don't see much evidence of progress politically in terms of sort of separating the real militant jihadi types who have a lot of the guns in the rebel forces. There's some real serious problems within the rebel movement, you know, in terms of the disparate factions, some of them being very radical, represented there.
And what about Egypt and what's happening there, Anne?
Well, in Egypt, it's always very hard to know exactly what's happening because it seems to change from day to day and minute to minute. And Egypt is interesting. It's one of the most interesting countries in this region for a number of reasons. But one is because it has so many moving parts. It has a very powerful and important business community. It has a very powerful elements of civil society, you know, organized groups and organizations in Egypt that exist that you don't have in a place like Libya and, of course, not in a place like Syria. There are many moving parts. And, of course, the interesting question for us now is whether Mohamed Morsi, having come to power through a democratic process, you know, what decision will he make? Will he begin to repeat the errors of his predecessor? Will he attempt to clamp down on, to repress and to destroy that Egyptian civil society? Or will he try to find some ways to negotiate it? I think he's going to have a lot of trouble being a totalitarian dictator, if that's what he intends to be, which, of course, we don't know yet, or a dictator of any kind, just because Egypt, the Egyptian state, it's not Iran. They don't have oil. It's not a strong state. It's not nearly as powerful. And he will have he won't have that same kind of ability to control people. The other thing he doesn't have, as far as I can see so far, is an economic program. He doesn't have a way to help Egyptians begin to become more prosperous, more wealthy. He doesn't have a way of spreading through the society yet, and that's going to backfire on him.
And, of course, he claims that he usurped all this authority and power was for the good of the democratic society moving forward. Where is the proof in that pudding?
Yeah, he says that this was very transitional. What we're talking about here is that his office issued a declaration stating that his laws, that Morsi, President Mohamed Morsi's laws, were going to be final and binding and could not be appealed by any way to any entity. That is a reflection of the fact that he was elected with no constitution, no parliament, and no defined powers. So, and there was a tension between Morsi and the generals and the army, and now there is a tension between Morsi and the constitutional tribunal that is trying to define what are the rules that apply. Morsi appointed a panel of individuals charged with drafting a new constitution. And in between, there was a vacuum. So he issued this, and the Tahrir Square effect took over. Essentially, the Egyptians no longer take diktats from the power, and they took to the streets. And in very unholy alliances where you, in the streets, you found liberal elements of the Egyptian society plus former supporters of the former regime.
The Muslim Brotherhood,
and the youth, and the other side, you had the Muslim Brotherhood. So what happens now is that they suddenly moved forward the drafting of this Constitution, 230-something articles of the Constitution, and they have to put it to a vote, to a referendum, to accept it or not. In the process, a lot of the liberal elements, this is the drafting committee is dominated by Islamists, and they passed a series of articles that were disappointing or unacceptable even to the non-Muslim parts of the drafters of the Constitution, who walked out. And Morsi then replaced them with his loyalists. So it remains to be seen what happens when this new draft is taken to a vote in a couple of weeks.
What do you think is next, Tom?
Well, this, as Moises just said, this sort of jerry-rigged constitution, it was basically just thrown together in the last few weeks. We'll be put to a vote, and then we'll see. I mean, it's really just instead of starting sort of from scratch and building a constitution that really made sense for modern Egypt, they sort of took a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
And what about the courts?
Well, the courts still represent the Mubarak regime. So you've got the military, which is its own power center. You've got the courts, which are carryovers from the Mubarak regime, and you've got the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, as far as the Muslim Brotherhood and Mohamed Morsi, they've actually, to me, seemed rather amateurish in this whole thing. And I think it's an interesting parallel to Eastern Europe, where you had Democrats sort of in the shadows for so many years, but when they finally had the opportunity to lead, they knew what they wanted to do and they were able to do it. The Muslim Brotherhood has been in the shadows all this time, and they come out and they seem absolutely incompetent. They, you know, Mohamed Morsi is just, sometimes this, you know, this group has acted with in a farcical manner, and it makes you think they've been waiting all this time for a chance to exert power, and now they have it and they're blowing it.
Tom Chilton of NPR, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, and you wanted to add to that.
No, I just wanted to add that this augments the point I made earlier about thinking about transitions in advance. Actually, in Eastern Europe, that was done in small ways, but the Polish and Hungarian economists and others had begun talking about how you would transform a centrally planned economy many years before the transition. And, you know, if you had that kind of thinking in Egypt, if you had it in Syria, you might see better outcomes afterwards.
Let's talk about the latest on the Greek bailout plan. What's happening there? Will it do enough to reduce Greece's debt burden, Moises?
Yes, the good news this week that the markets, in fact, took very well was the Eurozone, the countries in Europe, and the IMF have reached an agreement to reduce Greece's public debt to 110% of the economy, of the GDP, by 2022. So there's going to be a set of cuts and other initiatives and privatizations and so on to try to reach that. That sort of stabilizes the debt dynamics of Greece. But still, we don't know, because what we have discovered is that what happens in the streets of these countries is as important as what happens in the conference centers where these decisions are made. And immediately after that, we just got a report that the Eurozone unemployment hit new highs in October, especially in Italy and Spain. And that, together with a very dire situation in the Spanish banking system, where finally the European countries and others have to provide the funds to bail out some four or five very large banks in Spain. So the situation continues to be unsettled. The debate about the link between cuts and austerity and growth continues. It is both ideological, it is political, but there is a huge human suffering going on in this country.
And Germany continues to refuse to write down Greece's debt.
Germany continues to refuse to write it down all the way, although much has been written about Germany that I think is incorrect. The Germans have a real dedication to keeping the Eurozone together, much more so than is usually. Usually you see reports about discontent in Germany and we don't want to pay for the Greeks and so on. Actually, the Germans as a country, the German business class, has made more money out of the Eurozone, and it's been of more benefit to the German economy than to really anybody else. And it's and the German determination to save this thing and to keep it going and to make sure that that it stays together has been underestimated absolutely from the beginning. And much of what's going on, you know, the austerity programs in Spain and elsewhere, you know, these were things that should have happened a long time ago that may have to happen one way or another. And the Germans have been don't underestimate their ability to continue to support them.
Tom.
Well, Diane, you know, Moises sounded a sort of a hopeful note, but on the other hand, how many times have we seen bailout deals reached and then the targets just become laughable after a while? I mean, you're right. Greece is supposed to get its debt down to a manageable level by 2022. But within a few days, we saw the Financial Times came out with a document that showed that actually that there's been some sort of playing with the numbers on the part of the EU. They're trying to make the best of a bad situation. The OECD is now predicting that Europe is going to go into a recession. This just seems to be this tale without end. I mean, it really, for me, is getting harder and harder to see the moment when the European economy actually turns around and Spain, France, Italy, and Greece have all dealt with their debt problems. It's way down the road.
And on that note, we'll take a short break. Tom Jelton of NPR and Applebaum of the Washington Post and Slate and Moises Naim of El País, they're all here to respond to your questions.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Ally Bank, who believes intelligent news and knowledgeable customer service should be available around the clock. Learn more at allybank.com. By Moo, printing personalized business cards with the option of a different image on every card. Moo, we love to print. At moo.com/radio. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. This is NPR.
Is it okay to break up with someone with an email? If you're out at a restaurant with someone, is it rude to answer your cell phone, check email, or tweet? On the next Fresh Air, we get answers from Philip Galanis, who writes an etiquette column for the New York Times. His book, Social Cues, is now out in paperback. Join us.
Right off the bat, we have an email from Chris saying Tom Jelton was wrong when stating that because polonium-210 is radioactive, it decomposes quickly. Polonium-210 has a half-life of roughly 380 years, meaning very little will have decomposed in less than a decade. That's in total contrast to an AP story you were quoting, published in the Washington Post, Tom.
Diane, here's the dirty little secret. A lot of us who come on this program, all that we know is what we read in the newspapers, right? And that's right. There was an AP story, and I'm going to quote from it, and I have no doubt that our listener is correct. But this story says, polonium disintegrates rapidly, and experts have cautioned that too much time may have passed since Arafat's death to reach a conclusive result. Now, that story may be wrong, and the listener may be right. All I know is what I read.
And we'll look for more clarification as we move along. And Applebaum, let me ask you about President Obama's meeting with the incoming president of Mexico, Peña Nieto, at the White House. What topped that agenda?
Well, the agenda was topped by all the issues you would expect, border security, immigration. But what I think was important about it and the kind of attention that the administration clearly wanted to give to it was that what we are beginning to see is, we're beginning to understand that our image of Mexico is not really reflective of the truth. I was in Mexico last spring, and what impressed me above all else, having read articles about drug wars and, you know, the terrible borders situation and crisis, I got there and I found a middle class country. You know, absolutely people with cars and living in a way that we would describe as middle class. And of course, it's become in the last several years a middle income country. It's becoming wealthier. We know that immigration has over the border has in fact fallen. Mexico is now outstripping Brazil in its growth rates. And we need, I think, the United States needs to begin to recognize Mexico not just as a source of trouble and violence on our southern border, but as a potential partner, as a business partner, and as a country which is beginning to catch up with the developed economies. And I thought that this meeting and the kind of prominence it was given by the administration was a step in that direction.
Tom.
I have my own sort of feeling about this, which is that I lived in Mexico for 4 years, and the PRI, which was this corrupt one-party government, you know, was finally pushed out of office through this kind of democratic uprising. And I was convinced that the PRI would never be coming back because it was such a discredited political institution. And now Enrique Peña Nieto was a candidate of the PRI, and the PRI is now back to playing a dominant role in Mexican politics. This is one of the most extraordinary stories of an entirely discredited party that has now come back, recast itself, as Anne said, as this modern, pro-development, modernizing force, whereas the right-wing party, the Partido Acción Nacional, the PAN, has largely been eclipsed. It's really quite an extraordinary turn of events.
All right. I'm going to open the phones first to Little Rock, Arkansas. Good morning, Charles.
How's it going today?
Good, thanks.
I have a short question I'll take off the air.
Sure.
I keep hearing about the European debt crisis and Greek austerity measures and what have you. But it's in complete separation with the United States and their problems. Is there not some sort of correlation between the two? And should we separate them as much as we do?
Moises.
It's a very good point that Charles makes. And of course, the two are connected. These are two of the largest economies in the world. But it's very important to stress that the United States economy is recovering. There is expansion, and the GDP is expanding, and the financial sector is stable. That's not the case in Europe. Europe continues to have, in many countries, as we just talked about, Spain and others, where the banks still are in need of bailouts. They have a very, very high unemployment. Just to give you a sense of proportion, the United States unemployment is under 8, is about 7-something. In Spain, is about 20-something. In Italy is very high, and elsewhere is very high. So yes, they are two connected, but these two regions, these two large economies, are pursuing very different policies.
All right, to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, Helen.
Good good morning, Diane. Thank you very much. I wanted first to say for your wonderful program.
Thank you.
And the enlightenment that we receive from it all the time. I want to go back to Yasser Arafat and the exhumation, the polonium story, if I may, and make a question and a comment. In addition to the AP report that was quoted by Tom Jilton, I have been reading and hearing of reports by eminent scientists across the world who question the possibility of traces of polonium still traceable, so to speak, on clothing 7 to 8 years after Arafat has died. One has to wonder, indeed, whether there was a motive in all of this to inflame issues in the Middle East and again raise the issue of the possibility of an assassination. And, of course, who would be the villain in the piece, obviously, would only be Israel.
Anne.
Well, that confirms what I said at the very beginning. You can't put a conspiracy theory to rest by investigating it. And, you know, it is perfectly possible that this investigation will deteriorate into an argument about polonium. And
all
nobody
right.
will believe either side.
Let's go to Indianapolis. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you so much for your show. And
Thank
I
you.
Really appreciate taking my call. My question is in regard to some of the parallels that we might be able to draw from what happened in Libya to what's going on now. It's obvious that the government is declining. However, I know Gaddafi was very outspoken, his regime, his sons, leaders. We always got daily updates about what was going on. Very little from Assad and his regime. Just curious as to what that might mean and what we can draw from that. Thank you.
Moises.
What essentially means is that international journalists have been kept out of Syria, whereas they were allowed more widely in Libya. Essentially, it is, and now that they shut down the internet and the airport, is yet one more step towards isolating the country from the rest of the world. It's going to become harder. We already have several journalists that risked their lives and lost their lives by trying to cover Syria. And so, yes, we knew far more about Libya and other places because journalists from the international media were allowed in.
Let's go now to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hi, Nick.
Hello.
Go right ahead, sir.
I'm just curious to know what the panelists think about or if there's been any conversation that the Obama administration would open up conversation with Mexican authorities about whether or not to confront Colorado and Washington's new legalization and taxation law of marijuana, a situation that directly impacts the civil war currently waging in Mexico.
Tom.
Yeah, so we have these two states that have legalized recreational use of marijuana, but marijuana is illegal under federal law as well. So there's this kind of contradiction now between state and federal law in those two cases, and we don't know how that's going to be resolved. If we were to sort of enlarge this and actually see kind of a national legalization of marijuana, the question that Nick raises is what impact would that have on Mexico, on Mexico's drug war? Now, there have been actually quite a few studies about this that show that the drug cartels would lose a lot of money because you make a lot more money off illegal drug traffic than you do off legal drug traffic. But not so much money that they would go out of business, because actually marijuana is a small part of the drug cartel's business. Most of their money is in cocaine and methamphetamines. And so I think it would be a little bit wishful thinking to think that the legalization of marijuana would sort of resolve the terrible drug violence in Mexico.
All right. Caller here in Washington, D.C., from Brandon. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. I have two quick comments. One of them is regarding the Palestine new status in the UN, and it's kind of ignoring any past actions and just looking forward. And that being, I see that as a positive step forward, and one that holds Palestine accountable for their actions as an adult-like state. And also, it will put any attacks on the Palestinians under a different microscope and truly identify who is, working towards peace. The second brief comment I have is regarding the fall of the Syrian president. And if the rebels do succeed, I see that just opening a whole new springboard of Arab Spring-type actions to follow, this being the largest and the most successful effort by any rebel group, and many other countries will probably follow. And I think the world needs to be prepared for that and not just the transition for the rebel government.
All right. Thanks for calling, Anne.
Well, I'm not, I didn't hear the question there, so I'm not sure how to answer it.
The question on the first part was about the Palestinians at the UN.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I thought his comment about Syria actually was interesting. And I was the most interesting piece of it. And the and I'd like to ask about the underlying assumption, which is that the fall of Assad will lead to a new Arab Spring and changes everywhere else. You know, the fall of Assad could lead to many different things in many different places. And one of the interesting things about the Arab Spring, which makes it quite different from 1989, is that you haven't had a kind of homogenous kind of change. You know, each of these countries turns out to have very different ethnic and political compositions. The effect of the end of the dictatorship has different effects. I would say this is 1848 rather than 1989, and I wouldn't necessarily expect a wave of optimistic change following this one.
Tom.
Well, look at the countries where you have not yet seen an Arab Spring, and the obvious ones are Saudi Arabia, and to some extent, well, you've seen Bahrain, but it has not been, successful. So the question then is: say, if Assad were to fall, are you going to see kind of a spillover effect in Saudi Arabia? I don't think so.
All right, to continue our discussion about polonium, our producer Becca Kaufman says that according to the IAEA, the half-life of polonium-210 is about 138 days, not 380 years. And one listener writes, with approximately 20 half-lives passing since Arafat's death in 2004, there would be less than 1/100 of 1% of the original amount remaining essentially untraceable. Yay, Tom.
No, yay the AP. I was just
yay
quoting the
AP. Absolutely.
But as Anne has mentioned several times, it doesn't matter. People that believe what they believe are immune to data and science. So the conspiracy and the polonium and everything else will continue to be part of the story.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Littleton, New Hampshire. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, and thank you, Diane and NPR, for maintaining your program.
Thank you.
Recognizing this is an oversimplification, I would like to see our U.S. aid to Palestine and Israel keyed to humanitarian uses, and I'd like to see it reduced when shots are fired. That is, anyone who attacks across the border, both sides lose some aid.
Tom Gelton.
That's a non-starter, if there ever was one. The United States is wholeheartedly in a bipartisan manner committed to Israel's security. And I just cannot imagine any retreat from that commitment, no matter who governs or who is president.
All right. And final call from Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning, Frank.
Hi. Okay, you know, I was wondering why the Senate already, the Republicans, actually had a bill ready to go once the Palestinians, wanted to get, recognition. And I was more or less looking at the Gallup polls, and according to the Gallup polls, 65% of Americans do not support the Israeli violence against, this is in Lebanon, they do not support that. And I was wondering if the U.S. Senate is worried about supplying Israel with cluster bombs that blew off the hands of children and the death of all these people in Palestine, according to what I read over the last 13 years, two children are killed by the Israeli occupation every week for the last 13 years.
All right, Terry, thanks for your call. Moises, any comment? And Tom.
You know, there's, I have, Israel is not a country or the Palestinian territory. I've never visited there. This is not my specialty. And, you know, it is so hard to sort of weigh the opposing arguments. I know many Israelis feel that the American media does not pay attention to Israeli children, you know, who are injured in these, in this most recent round of clashes. I think, you know, it's terrible what happens to children in conflicts. I can't really address which side has been sort of unfairly portrayed.
And
yeah, you know, we've had a ceasefire in Israel in the last few days, but we don't have an end to a war. This is an ongoing conflict. It's not, there is no peace. The ceasefire is a temporary stop. In wars, civilians are murdered. Terrible things happen to people on both sides.
And terrible things happened in Bangladesh this week when a factory fire killed 112 workers, triggered angry protests very quickly. Moises, what happened?
What happens in all these countries is that industrialization is proceeding much faster than industrial safety, that unions, and that measures to protect the workers. This is a factory where 1,400 workers were operating, and their doors were closed. So when the fire locked, and so where the fire, 70% of these 1,400 were women. So when the fire broke, they mostly died inside the factory.
Moises Naim and Applebaum, Tom Jelt. Thank you all so much. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.